Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Penske Podcast. If you haven't tuned in before, this is a podcast where we are going through all 178 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, giving our thoughts and feelings about each and every one. Right now we're up to episode 23 of season 5. This one is called I, Borg. It was directed by Robert Letterman, written by Rene Echevarria, aired back on May 10th, 1992. In this episode, an injured Borg is found amid a crashed scout ship. As they restore him to health, the crew must decide whether or not to develop him into a weapon of mass destruction. Trekabout is here to talk about this one. It's going to be the return of the Borg. We haven't seen them since The Best of Both Worlds. And how does it go? Does the show pull off reintroducing these iconic villains? Trekabout is here to discuss. And right after this audio break, we are going to go deep on I, Borg.
Riker to Enterprise.
Go ahead, number one.
We found the wreckage of a small craft.
One survivor. It's a Borg, male, adolescent. He's badly hurt.
Sir, there is no indication of other Borg activity within sensor range.
Away team, prepare to return to the ship.
Captain, we can't leave him here. He won't survive.
I think the captain understands that.
I don't.
The Borg usually collect their dead.
He's not dead.
The transmission...
At least not yet.
The transmission that we intercepted was probably a homing signal. We have to assume they're on their way.
Let me at least stabilize his condition. Give him a chance of surviving until they get here.
Your concern is noted, Doctor. But any intervention on our part would alert the Borg to our having been there.
I'm afraid we've turned that corner already.
Kill it now. Make it appear that it died in the crash.
Leave no evidence that we were ever here.
Security measures must be taken before we beam it on board.
Thank you, Captain. Standing by.
To quote the cinematic experience that is Speed, Keanu Reeves' finest feature, pop quiz hotshots. So in this episode, Picard and Guinan are fencing each other. What is the other episode that Picard fences in?
Oh, no. That was Riker and his father, and it wasn't
fencing.
Factor. It was some weird, like, jujitsu thing.
Nope. What? It's a first season episode. Just to either describe the plot or name it, if you can, if you remember.
Ooh. Was it the episode where Picard is very badly written?
Oh. Yeah, that's close enough. So yes, it's we'll always have Paris. The Mannheim time experiment is the other episode where he fences. So I was surprised that they brought that back for this, but I guess he's going at it. It brought up the weird question to me. Why does the ship have dedicated fencing areas when you can do everything on the holodeck? Why does it have
I thought that was the holodeck.
No, apparently it's a real thing.
Well, I think the holodeck is mostly used for sex.
Yeah.
So it was busy. You know, I mean, they kind of reserve it for people getting their jollies out. That
Riker was, you know, watching a bunch of women play the violin or whatever that instrument was.
Yeah.
Even while he polished his trombone. I always thought that was weird that they, especially early in the first season, they had these dedicated rooms that there's really no reason to have them. But anyway, we're going to talk about I, Borg right now. So it's the return of the Borg. We haven't seen them since Best of Both Worlds. Apparently, according to internet hearsay, because the Borg, as the juggernaut enemies that they are virtually impossible to bring back. So, guys, what do you think about...
Well, thank God they never brought him back after this one.
So this is the Borg returning. So what do you think of an episode as, like, how does this actually manage to do in terms of bringing back the Borg as an episode?
I would say this is one of my favorite TNG episodes. This is a very TNG episode in that it's... Hang on a second. Have we had the episode where the crystalline entity gets destroyed yet?
Yeah, we have.
Okay, good. No, because I'm going to talk about that. I don't want to spoil for them. TNG has a lot of, I guess, one of the more emblematic moments in Star Trek in the franchise, the defining moment, is that devil in the dark moment when they realize the creature that's attacking can be reasoned with, can be made, they can make an alliance and a friendship with it, and they can, you know, both you know, achieve things peacefully. And, you know, TNG has really run with that in a lot of things. One of the most, you know, iconic moments of the series for me is that is the episode where the crystalline entity returns, and before it's destroyed, it's almost having a moment where it's they are about to communicate with it. I do like Star Trek when it gives the opportunity to reason with and communicate and form a friendship with a member of an enemy species. And this is a moment, this is how do we make friends with the Borg? They are this monolithic entity. They don't have any sense of individuality. They are the best enemy for the TNG era because they are the opposite of everything that TNG stands for. And this episode, they managed to find a way to form a deep and form a friendship with a member of the Borg in a way that gives hope that maybe someday the Borg can change. And I guess for bringing back the Borg, that's a very interesting way to do it.
Yeah, I think it's the I think it was probably the only way that they could have done this, because you can't really go bigger. It starts it starts to stop making sense. Like, I think, like, this is not to, like, distract, but I think almost the weirdest part about bringing the Borg back is the logistics of how close are they to the Federation. You know what I mean? Like, if they have all these scout ships flying around, why is the crew so concerned about the Borg finding them? They clearly know where they are.
They do state in the very beginning of the episode that they are surveying the star system for possible colonization. I guess the implication being that they are fairly far out, perhaps not even in Federation space. I don't know. That's kind of left ambiguous. Sure. So
yeah, I mean, it goes with kind of where they were at the beginning of the of the series in the far point where they are kind of going further out. So yeah, this could be, you know, further than this is, you know, several light years past where they were a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that I mean, yeah, the scout ship thing is a little strange. I mean, the Borg in general, I find strange. And, you know, I don't we just recorded our First Contact podcast, which I won't get into very much because I don't want to spoil things for people that are listening to this. But, you know, that movie deals with the Borg, and that's kind of the comeback of the actual Borg, not just a little scout ship and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think that in general, this is the only way that they could bring the Borg back, at least in TNG.
Yeah, because
they built them up as too much of a unstoppable force to really, you know, you can't, if you know what, and that was kind of the problem with you know, with Voyagers, that they kept bringing the Borg back and back and back, and it's like, okay, the unstoppable force is actually kind of ridiculous at this point
after the fourth time you've defeated them. First Contact does try to actually go it both ways, now that I'm thinking. Like, it tries to make the bigger Borg story, but it also tries to make it more personal, and I'm not sure if it's successful in doing it both ways, but certainly for iBorg, they do the more personal, and it works very well.
Yeah.
That's something that, I mean, they don't have to really rely on the largeness of the story. They can just make it all character stuff.
And I also think that it does, you know, for people that have not seen The Best of Both Worlds, because, of course, you know, this is from an era when people just kind of dropped in and out of television shows and didn't really need to have watched previous episodes to understand it. And they do kind of reset the expectations for the audience when very early on in the episode, Troy goes into Picard's ready room and is like, hey, so remember when you were kidnapped by the Borg? Are you doing all right now?
Right.
Like, you know, and so that kind of is an interesting way to approach it. But also, the what really strikes me about the beginning of the episode is how scared everyone is of one Borg. And it really does go a long way towards still maintaining the integrity of the Borg as this kind of unstoppable threat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think they try to play it both ways here, and it's sort of like I mentioned, the logistics of it are kind of a little bit odd to me, just because I can't understand how close they're supposed to be or why they haven't come back. And also I think the more you get into the Borg, the more you explore them, the sort of less sense they start to make. Especially just the fact that, like, you know, in Best of Both Worlds, they have the thing that the sort of narrative drive is that the Borg, they capture Picard, the Enterprise crew recaptures Picard, and they take him back as Locutus. And they're like, why can't the Borg just disconnect from him? And they say, well, you can't just disconnect because of the Borg. It's like trying to cut off your own arm or something. Like one individual is connected to the whole collective, so you can't just separate yourselves. They sort of do that here, but the problem is that Hugh is totally disconnected from the collective. So I don't understand why the Borg would care about going back to get him.
You know? Yeah, it's like they turn his Wi-Fi off almost.
Right, and it's not like... So the analogy of cutting off your own hand is apt because the Borg didn't have a choice. It was more like, you know, it's like that Franco movie. A boulder fell on their hand and it got separated.
Hmm.
So it's not like it's up to them to deal with it. So I don't understand why they have to go back and get him.
Well, I mean, at the very end, when the Borg come back, you see them taking parts off of the dead, and it's almost implied that if Hugh had been dead, they would do the same for him. But since he's alive, there seems to be, it's like they're collecting their hard drives or something getting. And so, you know, for whatever reason, you know, from the Borg's perspective, these three Borg were suddenly cut off, and you know, they don't really know what happened to them, but they're going to get the black boxes. And they come back, they find he was still alive, and, you know, they take what they can from the dead ones.
Yeah, I think,
you know, what that really speaks to is, you know, and that's a good, you know, sort of, you know, retcon or explanation for it as much as anything is. But, you know, part of the problem, of course, is that we are talking about a fairly late TNG episode as well. And, you know, TNG's plotting and they started to get a little more desperate as the show went on. And I think that while I Borg is a really strong episode of the show, I think it's also one of the last really strong episodes of the show.
Are your listeners in for a treat, Wes.
I know. Two seasons left, guys.
Not to say that season 6 and 7 of TNG are bad by any stretch of the imagination. They're certainly good episodes in there, but you know, we're not really talking about a lot of classic episodes from here on out. I mean, and you know, you'll be doing The Inner Light in a couple weeks, which is probably, you know, obviously that's usually in everyone's top 10 list, at least for TNG.
Yep.
And I think that The Inner Light is probably the last great episode of TNG. I don't really consider like the series finale a great episode just because it's the series finale. And so, you know, it's a good episode, but it's not a TNG episode. It's kind of a summation of everything that had come before.
Right.
So yeah, you have to look at it kind of that in that context too, where they waited so long to bring the Borg back. I think because they had to come up with a story that, mm-hmm. that made sense, and this is a good story. It makes sense, but there are also problems with bringing the Borg back that perhaps they were never really able or ready to explain.
I mean, part of it does have to do with the way that TNG handles its continuity, in that it just kind of makes an episode and then later they'll go back and, you know, they'll take up and they'll kind of write a sequel to the episode. So we are going to see a sequel to this episode, you know, later on, but it's not like they were thinking ahead of what this would mean. So for example, at the end, they talk about, you know, oh, well, you know, they are going to, you know, they're going to wipe Hugh's memory, but, you know, they are going to scan and there is going to be that glimmer of individuality which makes its way into the collective's information, and maybe they'll be able to, you know, maybe that will make a change, you know, that will be the beginning of a sea change for the Borg. They wrote that line without thinking about, you know, where it would go. It's not like if they said, okay, well, you know, then for the finale, you know, we're going to deal with that. We're going to have some Borg who have been, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so when they do pick it up, it is kind, it's almost seems as if it was by another writer who didn't read the original script kind of a thing.
Yeah, that, I think that's interesting. It's also, it ties into your, you know, you were talking about the continuity. One thing I've been noticing, just because it's been a long time since I've sort of gone back and watched a totally non-serialized show all the way through. It's kind of funny how scattershot the characters are, just because of the nature of how they have to deal with story. I think I, Borg is funny because I, Borg is like the angriest Star Trek episode I think I've ever seen. Like Picard and Guinan, the two most unlikely characters to be raging about things, are so angry in this one that while I like how it goes for the Picard thing, the thing that always makes me laugh about Picard is that he's basically very mellow and reserved in all episodes except when a Borg appears and he loses his fucking mind. Like, he goes crazy, especially in, like, First Contact and stuff like that. So it's interesting. It makes sense on a narrative level, but it always sticks out to me that okay, and this is a Borg episode, so Picard has to get a little bit crazy in this one.
I mean, I feel like that was earned to a degree in First Contact, and in general, you know, they could have gone further with this. I don't think they quite knew how to exactly write this story, but Picard reacts to the Borg as if he's a rape victim in a lot of ways. He has been violated and assaulted on his person, and this is a trauma which keeps reappearing. Whenever he sees a Borg, he is being triggered, essentially. He is flipping out because he is reliving the trauma of what happened, which was absolutely horrible. And so, you know, I think it does make an interesting note for him that he is completely unhinged when a Borg is around. And, you know, it does, you know, the way Troy does have that conversation at the beginning, you know, he's saying, oh, I'm fine. And she's, well, yes, I know you're fine, but sometimes it can still bubble up after you've been healed. You know, I don't know. That's, I think, where, you know, I do like that they give Picard that treatment, and in a way that does kind of – it does sell the Borg a bit, because if Picard can't handle himself around them, they really are that much of a threat.
Yeah.
Picard is unflappable in any situation. He is always brave. He is always, you know, worrying about his crew. He is always making or trying to make the right decision. But when the Borg are around, he's wrong.
Which is – strange too, because I mean, I want to talk about Guinan, and I'm sure you kind of have that on your list there, but because she's very interesting in this episode, and I think she's very integral to what happens. But the thing is that I never understand about this episode and sort of Picard's reaction to 3 of 5 later Hugh is that they know that Borg can be disconnected from the collective because Picard was a member of the collective that was disconnected from it. And, you know, and so to me, it's like it speaks to the nature of how TNG never really had a clear idea of what the Borg were, and the kind of fundamental tension at the heart of the concept of the Borg is that, like you said, the more you examine them, the less sense they make. And this episode goes a long way towards showing that, because it doesn't make a lot of sense that Hugh can be disconnected, but at the same time, they know that they can disconnect drones because Picard was disconnected. So there's a lot of weird kind of stuff here that doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. And what does it mean if a drone can be disconnected and reconnected to the collective at will?
Yeah, seeing the Borg in the episode where Q first introduces us to him, where they're this mysterious, weird, and terrifyingly creepy entity, and then in Best of Both Worlds, which is their proper episode. I mean, they get 3 episodes. That's a that's a fantastic villain, but they can leave a lot of things unexplained because, you know, it's Star Trek. You know, they do that about tons of villains of the week. They're, you know, cultures don't quite make sense, but it's okay because it's that kind of a story. And yeah, the more that we see them, the more holes they should be able to, and the more obvious it is that there are holes.
So here's a question for you. I think a lot of the problem, especially with what you were saying, Eric, about their sort of confusion as a race, comes from the one scene in Q Who where they show a baby Borg. Right?
Mm, yeah.
So we don't. So because that's part of that episode, it's sort of canon that apparently the Borg, in addition to assimilating, like absorbing races and actually like kidnapping people and making them turn into Borg, which is a very zombie thing, they also have this thing where they breed like individuals and then train them or like raise them as Borg. Which one would you prefer the Borg to be?
I think they can be both.
I think it makes a lot more sense for the Borg to, because the Borg are essentially cancer, right? And the Borg as a concept is this sort of like a hungry force that is out there just to take in as much as they can and sort of destroy. And for my interpretation, I don't think it makes a ton of sense for the Borg to be. I mean, I don't think they're actually like having sex. I think they're probably
test tube babies. Yeah.
They're cloning these Borg babies or something like that, and sort of accelerating their growth. But
you can imagine they need a specific body type for a certain function, for example. And so they're, you know, if they can't assemble, you know, for example, they might that may be a baby from a species that's been so long extinct but has a unique physiology they need to produce more
maybe.
But here's the thing. Yeah, we're fanoning this.
Right, yeah, you could definitely make a lot of interpretations for it. But I think at the end of the day, the Borg, you know, at the end of the day, I think the more you talk about the Borg, the less sense they make. And it's probably like not that really, I guess, sort of, it's not very productive to sort of talk about them as something that's supposed to make sense, because I think at the end of the day, the Borg are really much more interesting for me, I guess, as a antithesis to the Federation and sort of some of the Star Trek ideals and kind of hitting the limits of it, and what exactly are the limits of tolerance, what exactly are the limits of peaceful exploration and cooperation. Is it the Borg? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I think that this episode is going a long way towards saying the Borg are not an obstacle to that. They can be changed and reasoned with, and that it seems like an optimistic ending, but is it? I don't know.
Well, knowing the future to a degree allows us to say that no, it's not really an optimistic ending, because obviously the Borg are recurring villains. It's not like, you know, it's not like their appearance in Voyager are, well, we're making a treaty with the Borg, and here's, you know, we're learning to, he's giving me a look. God damn it.
I like it when Richard is very, very astute. He said a lot of things that I just have to kind of on track about, like,
because you're in Deep Space Nine right now.
Yeah, just kind of, you know, go, okay, yep, sure, that's my, yeah. And, you know, be very quiet. But sometimes he says things that realize that he may not know, that make me realize he may not know Star Trek nearly as well as he thinks he does. So.
I guess my answer to that is yes, you can figure out a reason for both. But as far as I'm concerned, a baby Borg is a scary image. Picard turned into a Borg is a scary image. The Borg work in whatever way is the scariest, because they are a very effectively scary villain.
Yeah,
I think they are terrifying, and that, you know, that for me is more important than actually fitting it into a realistic framework. That said, it would be very nice if we could have both.
Sure. I mean, before I move on to the next topic, which will be their sort of like the culture of the Borg, I guess I would, my general point would be, the way they were originally conceived by Hurley, where they sort of create create biological organisms and then from birth they raise them into the Borg, makes more sense as their overriding like way of being. But the assimilation aspect and the fact that you can break people out of them is a better narrative device. So the Borg are more terrifying, and I think they're purely like originally were conceived to just be a sort of computer program gone mad, basically. And you can only get stories out of it if you have the people be assimilated, turned into zombies, and then you can rescue those people. And at that point, you start to wonder what their actual, the collective hold is over them. Where, you know, if you're raised as a baby to be a Borg, you can't see any other option than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, interestingly enough, that's making me remember that if I recall correctly, the original conception of the Borg was for them to be an insect race.
Right.
And they didn't do that for obvious reasons. I mean, mostly due to the fact that they would not have been able to pull it off with makeup. But
were there any there was or was not a connection with the conspiracy episode at the end of the first season?
Those were the insects that were supposed to be the Borg.
Yeah, because at the end they have them contacting them, and I believe we talked, and you said it's possible that that's the Borg, and you know that's why they're coming, and that's why you know Q is able to introduce them. But
that was kind of a dropped thing. They never really went back to that. So
unfortunate. And actually,
yeah, and I mean not. To, you
I
know.
Mean, it's not exactly on the top of the list of TNG's dropped plot lines.
Well,
but
and not to talk too much about Star Trek novels either. But there is a series of Star Trek novels that say that those little alien beings from Conspiracy were actually another race of Trill symbionts.
Sure, the bad Trills. Yeah,
the bad Trills. Yeah. So you know, there's all kinds of weird stuff that you know. And there's also like a whole series of Star Trek novels that actually talks about the origins of the Borg and how they were actually like, you know, originally created by like the Columbia NX-02 from like the 20s.
I would say, I mean, there's theories about stuff with V'ger too, right?
Like, yeah, that would also, you know, I do want to finish with that discussion because the Borg to me would be the species that they'd most be able to flesh out with the new series that's coming out. Because I think time has passed enough where, you know, like AI is now sort of a big concern about people. Like, you know, what'll happen when the singularity happens and like, mm-hmm. you know, artificial yeah. intelligence takes off. So I think that they'd be actually they were writing them in 92 and they didn't like I was reading the notes. They didn't want to say that what Picard is doing is a computer virus because people would have been like, what the fuck? What is a computer virus? Like, how does that work? Before we go into that, let's talk a little bit, I guess, about why do you think the Borg are the antithesis of the Federation, and like, what's their strength as a villain, basically?
Well, so I look at the Borg and I say, okay, so if you look at kind of the recurring beliefs or tropes or sort of philosophies of Star Trek, it's that the United Federation of Planets was founded on the belief that peaceful cooperation, you know, everybody is taken at face value in the Star Trek universe, and you can reason with anybody. There is no way that eventually you cannot find a way to communicate and come to some sort of common ground or understanding with any alien race or alien species or alien person. And the Borg, so far as we've seen, and iBorg is maybe the first step towards a different interpretation of the Borg as one that fits into that Star Trek idea, is that at least initially in Q-Who and the Best of Both Worlds, the Borg were not able to be reasoned with. The Borg are not able to have any sort of common understanding. The Federation doesn't have anything that the Borg wants that the Federation can give them without the Federation being assimilated.
Yeah.
You know, the Borg's goal is to assimilate new technologies and new alien species. And that's the only goal that they have. They don't want anything else. Well, so there's no way for the Federation or Starfleet to be able to have any sort of cooperation or coexistence with them or understanding.
There is, I mean, we talk about cancer and cancer as a, cancer is in a way a malady of a normal cell's functioning. In other words, it's basically the replication, routines in your cells going haywire, and the ability to shut off division gets destroyed for some reason. In a way, you know, and the Borg, you know, certainly are they are the cancerous version of the Federation in that, you know, what you said about the Federation believes in tolerance and understanding and communication, and there is no species that can't be reasoned with, and, you know, all species are on the same footing. Well, the Borg believe that, except instead of communication, replace that with assimilation. They believe that all species have something to offer them, that they're going to learn something from every single species, that the way they do that is assimilation, and that eventually every species is going to be assimilated because resistance is futile. You have the Federation wants – the Federation believes that it is possible to have disparate parts working together towards a common goal.
Yep.
The Borg almost feels like you need to have the common goal, but all the parts have to be the same.
Well, there's the interesting scene. It's where Geordi and Hugh are talking, and Geordi's doing all the experiments, and Hugh's like, why are you doing this? And Geordi says, we want to learn about you. And Hugh says, well, why don't you just assimilate us? It's faster. And it's like it's kind of a dark mirror where they are like, if anything, I think one weakness is, and I think the TNG does this sometimes a little bit too much, although it depends on the episode. I kind of wish that they had given more of a point of view to the Borg about like Hugh always yeah. Hugh comes across the episode basically very scared. And I would think that, like, if he had just had lines about how it's comforting to always have people around you reassuring you or something, you know, like, there must be some kind of comfort in being in the collective where a lot of minds are thinking about, like, one thing type of thing.
Yeah, he talks about, you know, how he feels lonely without them. And there is a – Hugh is one of the few times we see being a Borg as maybe kind of nice. obviously he ends up deciding to prefer individuality, and you know, going back to the collective is a sign of sacrifice from him. But at the same time, you know, it isn't like being in the collective is constant torture. It's not a life of constant horror. For somebody who has been raised in this entire time, it's nice. He has every single one of the others with him at all times.
Right.
And when that's taken away, that's scary. I mean, obviously for our main characters and for us, you know, that's a really horrifying thought, even for someone like, you know, Deanna Troi, who does hear psychic thoughts to a degree,
I wonder about that, though, because I actually was thinking about Betazoids when you talk about that.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that we know about Deanna Troi is that she's only half Betazoid, so she doesn't actually read thoughts. She just feels emotions. And close people, she can pass thoughts back and forth through, like, Riker or her mother.
I got the sense in especially one of the first Lwaxana appearances, she kind of chides Deanna for not using telepathy, and there is kind of the implication that if Deanna were using it regularly, she would be able to hear more people's thoughts. And she kind of says, like, I don't
maybe, but I think either way it probably doesn't really matter. But I think that that, you know, the thing about Betazoids and kind of the telepathic races in Star Trek, I think, you know, they've said as much in Star Trek, that, or one episode, I forget what it was, it might even have been a Deep Space Nine episode, that, you know, Betazoids can read each other's thoughts, and they're very open, and they just sort of have this thing where you can kind of, you know, and so you kind of think about it, and you think about it in terms of, like, how is that different from the Borg? You know, like,
right.
How is it if you live on a planet where everyone is telepathic and you're able to just sort of, like, exchange thoughts all the time, and people can hear what you're thinking and your innermost thoughts and feelings and beliefs, and everyone else has that same interpretation, and maybe, yeah, you can put some walls up and you can learn to put up a firewall, why would you, you know, and what is the conception of privacy on Beta Z and all that kind of stuff?
Well,
and so you look at that and you say, well, how is that different from the Borg? I don't know.
Well, yeah. Yep. Certainly Beta Z has a very, I mean, most of what we see in Beta Z society is filtered through Lwaxana, of course, but this is a woman who is extraordinarily individualistic, who, you know, she hears everybody's thoughts. She's in everybody's business. You know, she is very, you know, comfortable all the time. But would you say that she is in any way her personality is in any way submissive? No, that's certainly not. And so I think Beta Z has found a way of being open and individualistic. I mean, I think it comes off more as a, because you can hear everybody else's thoughts, you're not judging them, and whatever quirks they have, that's okay, and they're kind of allowed to explore those. You know?
Yeah, we talked about early Lwaxana episodes actually tended to make a little bit more sense to me, just because, like, her first appearance in Haven, she comes on and she's sort of, you know, people are walking around with her and she's, like, not finishing their sentences, but sort of saying out loud what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, mother, how dare you? But it's like, to me, that actually makes sense as to how Betazoids would actually be. Like, there would be no secrets between them. Like, they'd be very
bullshit.
Open with everything. Right, exactly. And so they don't really continue with that, but you'd think it would be the same. And in terms of the Borg, it would kind of be the same. You know, like, I think it's fascinating that, to bring it back around to the portrayal of how they do Hugh, I wouldn't have had him been so childlike in this. I would have had him be a little bit more, not talking like Data, but a little bit more of the efficiency of Data. And Data is curiously absent in this episode.
Say, he has, like, a scene or two at the beginning, but they go almost out of their way to, because it's interesting, you know, Data is very much one of those, because of his own experience, he does stick up for the dignity of life forms that are unusual or harder to classify or harder to understand. And so, you know, Data would in no way approve of this plan. This is a plan that Data would mutiny against.
Does it make sense that Picard comes up with this idea?
Especially going with the, you know, assault survivor kind of interpretation of his character, there are plenty of people who, you know, a crime happens to you. Well, I want to fucking see him fucking rot in jail. You know, I hope somebody stabs him in the shadow. You know, that's kind of, I think, where Picard's plan is coming from, that kind of a place. He sees the opportunity to wipe off out every member of the people who tortured him, and he's taking it. And of course, you know, he does end up having second thoughts once he gets to it, but it does take him a little while to make that question, and I do believe that from him.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's two, I mean, I think that that's kind of two different, you know, questions. I think thematically it makes sense and it's satisfying that Picard is the one that comes up with the plan. Realistically, is it, does it make sense? I don't know. Not really. I don't think that, you know, Picard is certainly an explorer. Picard is an intelligent man, but he's not a scientist necessarily. So you could kind of retcon that or sort of fan in that by saying that maybe he's using his experience as being a part of the collective to know exactly how to hit them.
The implication I got from the turn of events was that he realizes that something could be sent back into the Borg, and which does, you know, seem like a logical conclusion based on the information they'd given about how he's connected to. And then he just kind of tells Geordi and Data, all right, come up with this plan.
Yeah.
You know, come up with a virus that'll, you know, attack them. And of course it's, you know, turns out to be Data and Geordi who run with the yeah. fractal idea.
I thought it was a great opportunity for Worf's suggestion to be taken into consideration. You know, he'd be like, why don't we, you know, and I thought it was minorly odd that Picard seems like he's been thinking about this for a long time, because he comes up with it very quickly as to how to do this plan. It made me laugh too, just at the in the cold open, when Worf and Riker and Crusher beam down, Worf's suggestion is to like make it look like an accident, like being that they weren't there. I just imagine him like, you know, pouring a bottle of whiskey over the bodies and then like dropping the bottle next to him and like, oh, something happened. But yeah, I think it was. I think the show always suffers from, you have 45 minutes, so you have to jam these ideas in very quickly, and they sometimes feel like they just popped into place out of nowhere. So I guess let's talk about Guinan in terms of this episode. I don't know how many shows she has left. Probably not very many. So we have to enjoy her while she's here. She does another thing that this podcast always likes to do, which is everyone shits on Troy. So Troy comes in and is like, Captain, do you want to talk to me? And he says, no. No, she walks out, and then he goes and talks to Guinan about his problems because she is the replacement for Troy in this series. So what did you guys think of Guinan here?
I mean, Guinan's great. I like Guinan a lot as a character, and she's one of my favorite recurring characters on TNG and maybe even in all of Star Trek. I mean, certainly DS9 has some stiff competition for her. But I think that, and a large part of that, of course, is Whoopi Goldberg is great.
And I would say this is probably one of her best shots as Guinan. Like, she's good every time, but this time she's particularly good.
Her acting is... it really shines a light on some of the weaknesses of the other cast. She has the story a couple episodes ago. She talked about her imaginary friend, the Razor Beast or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it's the worst dialogue I think ever written, but she pulls it off and it's just like, well, good for you. Good for you, Whoopi.
I think, you know, a lot of that does have to do with the fact that Guinan's shtick is that she's telling stories. And so if she's going a little cheesy, well, she's telling a fable.
Right.
You know, but she does. But again, that's a subtlety that I think is within the performance. You know, she is able to pick it up and read it in that way.
Well, and what I like about Guinan in this episode is that Guinan has always been a character that is mysterious. We don't know a lot about her backstory or background. I mean, we learned way back in Q-Who from the second season that the Borg actually destroyed her planet. And she's one of the only survivors. We don't even know what her species is. I don't think that's revealed until...
Generations.
Until Generations, yeah. So... you know, this episode makes it a lot more explicit about how she feels about the Borg. I mean, it was obvious at the time how she felt about the Borg, but she doesn't. It's interesting because she's the one that stands up to Picard, and she's able to change her own mind about the Borg through Hugh, and she's the one who decides to change Picard's mind. And I think that, you know, that the key scene, of course, is when, you know, Picard is relaxing in his I don't know what the hell he's wearing, his loungewear.
And he insists she come in. It's like, John Luke, put a shirt on, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's inappropriate.
Little short shorts and a glass of whiskey or something. I don't know what's going on. But he's in for a good night. But, you know, and she sits down and Picard has obviously sort of been thinking about this a lot. And she has that great line where Picard is screaming at her. And she just very calmly is like, well, if you're going to kill this person, then you need to, you know, go meet him.
Yep.
And, you know, in this, I think this is one of the I think this is one of the only times that Guinan uses her ability to stand up to Picard. She doesn't necessarily do that a lot. And B, it's also a really nice callback to what she does in Best of Both Worlds, when she kind of bullies her way into talking to Riker about it as well and saying, you know, I've given up on Picard. You need to as well.
Yeah.
And this is almost the exact opposite of that, where she's saying, I have not given up on Hugh and you need to go meet him, which is an interesting thing to do.
What I like about Guinan in this episode is that, like, we've seen Picard be wrong. We've seen all the characters be wrong at some point and, you know, get over it and figure. We've even seen Kirk be wrong, you know.
We saw Picard be wrong in this episode with that outfit.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah. He was wrong in all the right ways, though.
Listen, man, you know, I mean, that's how I dress when I'm by myself.
Whenever someone comes to the door, you can't put your arm above your head. That's a very that's a very seductive greeting, and he does it a lot when people come to his little apartment. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
But we've never seen Guinan be wrong. Guinan is a person who is the wives character on the ship. She's the bartender, and you know, anytime anyone comes, she knows exactly what story to tell them.
She can tell she's not in the right universe. She's like that amount of right. You know,
yes!
Yesterday's Enterprise, she's like, this is not right. So she's always right, yeah.
She's always right, and except in this episode, she is wrong, and I really like that. I mean, I love that Star Trek gives its characters the ability to realize they've made a mistake, backpedal, and then do the right thing. But it means a lot that even Guinan is able to get to that point.
Is Guinan the most realistically written character then? Now, this is just kind of popping into my head, but she is the most, just because, you know, she is the one that's willing to give up on things. Like, if there's a lost cause, she sort of adapts to it and goes along with it.
Well, this is something I've been thinking about recently, especially in conjunction with all of the sort of news about the new Star Trek show that we don't even know anything about at this point, but there's rumors flying about what it's going to be about and when it's going to be set and what universe it's going to be set and all these things. And we are looking at the universe of Star Trek through the eyes of Starfleet. And most of the characters that we identify are Starfleet. And Guinan is really one of the only non-Starfleet civilian characters in TNG that we see more than once. So for her to, she acts as a good release valve or a good sort of tension reliever where, you know, she's the one who's kind of able to be realistic sometimes. And Starfleet and has always been predicated on the idea that we can figure out any problem. And yeah, part of that is because it's a TV show, but also because these are the best people and these are the people that do their job the best. And they know exactly what to do and optimistic, and they're always going to figure out what to do. You know, the Enterprise never gets destroyed until it does. And Guinan is just like kind of putting the brakes on that sometimes and saying, you know what, you need to be a little less gung-ho about your ability to fix things, because sometimes you can't fix things.
Well, you know something? I mean, that's the entire theme of the Kobayashi Maru, though. I mean, Guinan almost in this way acts as a living Kobayashi Maru. I mean, the reminder that there are unwinnable situations, but it's how you have to make the right choice even if there isn't an unwinnable situation.
Yeah.
Yep. So in tying into, we talked about the crystalline entity earlier. I actually don't like that episode, mostly because Picard in the crystalline entity's death episode seems almost insane, to the point where they're chasing after this organism that basically just obliterates planets and kills everybody on the planet. And he's going along and he's like, you know, we should just talk to this thing. We should talk to it and see why it's doing this, and maybe we can convince it to stop. And Riker, to me, in that episode is the voice of reason. But they write him as though he's crazy because he was having sex with that woman on the planet for a little bit and she died, and so he's supposed to be angry about that or something.
Right.
So, but Riker, to me, is making sense, or he's like, this thing is too dangerous. We have to do something about it. What do you think about the plan here? I guess this is sort of a personal philosophy thing, but I kind of agree with the Picard plan as to how to deal with the Borg. Because as they're written here, you're basically just about defending yourself from an enemy that is unwilling to give up, is unable to be like communicated with. You'll just be told that everything you say is irrelevant. Like,
You destroy one ship, it'll send another. You destroy that ship, it'll send another. And eventually, in a war of attrition, you will not win against the Borg. Yeah.
Right. If they were to ever send two ships at once, which would be an amazing idea for them to do, maybe, then things would go a lot worse. So I understand and I appreciate the dilemma of this episode. And, you know, the show takes a very TNG answer to it. But I do think what Picard is saying is sort of justifiable in how they want to go about with this plan. So what do you guys think?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, I don't know that we could really ask a syndicated television show of the late 80s and early 90s to make a defensible case for genocide.
Yeah.
I think that's probably a little bit too far for anything, that kind of show. But I think that maybe, yes, I don't know. I think that as the Borg are written, as the Borg are constructed, and as powerful as they are, I mean, if they were, and that's kind of a problem I have with the Borg in general, is that they're almost too perfect of a villain. You can't really destroy their ships very easily. They're very, very strong, and they only send one ship all the time. So you're like scared out of your fucking mind, because if they ever sent like 10, you would just be screwed.
Yeah. Right.
And so they're a little too powerful. And I feel like the Borg may have worked a little better if they were perhaps a little less technologically powerful than they are, but that's kind of a side issue. But I think that, yeah, I kind of agree with Picard in this episode, because I do think that as constructed in this episode and as written in this episode and previous episodes, the Borg are so much of an existential threat to not just the Federation, but all sentient life throughout the galaxy, that in a sense they have sort of, I guess, the Borg have given up their right to exist.
Right.
I don't know. To a degree that... See, this is one of those episodes that makes me very glad that I am a game developer and TV critic rather than somebody who is actually making these decisions, because I think the episode makes it clear at least at the very beginning of the episode, when you have Crusher, who is saying this is a patient, you know, she never uses the term genocide, but she almost finds that term too euphemistic. For what she, you know, says at one point, I want you to make this very clear. What you're proposing is that we exterminate an entire species. You know, yep. She is making it no bones about, you know, I don't like this. I will do my job, but I do not like this because this is beyond the pale. This is too immoral of an act. There is a line that one cannot cross. And frankly, if you ask Crusher between do we make this decision or do we die, she would feel that the moral option would be to die in a way.
And also frankly too, I mean, they're assuming that this plan would work.
Yes.
I mean if it doesn't work, then they've pissed the Borg off like mightily. Yeah. And you know, here come 500 Borg cubes.
Yeah. But you know, to a degree there are, see, we have to, because TNG is not as metaphorical or allegorical a show as the original series was, certainly. But at the same time, I have to extrapolate this into real world scenarios. And the easiest one for me to do is the end of World War II, where we felt that, you know, Japan is too strong. You know, they are going to eventually, and they're going to get technological might. And so we have the atom bomb. We're going to blow up Hiroshima. Like, that is considered by many people today to be, you know, a horrible, you know, that was an unconscionable act. And I guess to me, this is asking the question, well, you know, are we right in giving a virus that's going to destroy the Borg is the same as asking, were we right to drop the bomb on Hiroshima?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it sort of ties into that too. I think it's interesting to me just because it's philosophically interesting in that I would consider going through with Jean-Luc Picard's plan here. At the same time, I really do agree with the story is almost an allegory for like the role of culture and individual. Like, I think that there could be, you could be a part of a very bad culture, which is what the Borg are supposed to be here. But if you separate people from it, you know, the culture informing their actions is worse than them as individuals, I think, in a lot of cases. So I can also see that sort of aspect of it where that would be immoral. So it's like very tough to go around, and I like that sort of central tension, and not a lot of TNG episodes build off of that. I just think it's kind of fascinating.
Well, I think it's good that they turn the Borg into a moral clusterfuck. I mean, that frankly does make for more interesting television than, you know, there's a difference between we can kill all the Borg and we can change the Borg. So instead of assimilating, they're giving us, you know, cookies.
Right. Yeah. And I would feel much less worse about doing Picard's plan to them if they were the original conception of, you know, babies born, like, bred to become this. You know what I mean? That feels easier for some reason.
And I think, too, that the fundamental problem with the Borg as a concept is that I think Star Trek is trying to have its cake and eat it, too, when it comes to the Borg. You know, they want him to be this existential threat that is just, you can't reason with it. You can't stop it. It's basically just a living, breathing race of cancer. But at the same time, they want it to be able to be reasoned with, and they want it to be able to slot in nicely to the Star Trek philosophy. And I don't know if you can really do that.
Yeah, and they aren't necessarily good with creating the sense of tragedy that it takes these people to realize that this is the one thing that they, as you know, if they had decided in TNG that full stop, there is no way to to deal with the Borg. If the Hugh personality could not even emerge from, you know, this, if the entire time he was all, you know, because it's true. If the entire time this third of five had stayed third of five, had said resistance is futile, they may feel a little bad about what they're doing, but they're not going to feel awful. You know, they're not actually taking, you know, because Hugh has these puppy dog eyes. And, you know, that scene when, you know, he tells Geordi, oh, friends like you and me, you know, and it's
he says friends way too. It's the kind of, I think it's a criticism I would have is he's turned too much into a child in this. Which I would have undone, but I can understand the shot that hits me is the shot where Geordi installs a little energy thing in his cell, and he's just standing there sadly telling them resistance is futile. And I think that's interesting. Yeah,
maybe I feel like DS9 would have made it so that it turned out that, you know, Guinan was right in her thing about the faint, you know, when she pretends to be injured and, you know, she counters against Picard and she says, you felt sorry for me. I feel like, you know, maybe even DS9 would have made at the end Hugh was faking it in order to get as much information from these people as he could and manipulate them.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I would see it as the Borg ship would detect them at the end and attack them, and people would die. But they'd get away, but people would die because of it.
Yeah.
It's like that's the outcome. It's like you made a decision. Just know that it can come back to bite you sometimes.
Yeah,
interesting. Well, did you guys have any other thoughts about iBorg, or should we bring up final thoughts?
I think final thoughts would be good.
Final thoughts. I'm going to play an audio clip, and then me, Eric, and Richard are going to come back, and we're going to give our final thoughts and ratings for iBorg.
Locutus. Yes. I am Locutus of Borg.
Why are you here?
This is a primitive culture. I am here to facilitate its incorporation. Identify yourself.
Hugh.
Identify yourself.
We are Hugh.
This is not a Borg identification.
Third of five.
This culture will be assimilated.
They do not wish it.
Irrelevant.
They will resist us.
Resistance is futile.
Resistance is not futile.
I don't know about you guys, but I have a thing for titles. I really like good titles. I think iBorg is a good title, even though it's clearly just an homage to iRobot. I think if iRobot didn't exist, it would be a great, great title. Just because of the simplicity of what it gets the idea across is. But iBorg, interesting. It's a very late season 5 episode. And I'm surprised it's late in the season because the idea seems strong enough that it doesn't seem like a late season episode. It seems like one that they could have put in the first 10 and felt good about it. So what we usually do here is we give a rating on a scale of 1 to 5 about these episodes, 1 being the absolute worst and 5 being all-time classic. So I'll start this one off. I think I'm going to give this one a 4. It's like a very strong 4. I don't know why I wouldn't give it a 5. I think I'm going a little bit meta with this rating, and I'm I'm considering what this episode does to the Borg and taking that into account in my final rating. What do you guys think? Where would you rank this one?
Yeah, I'd say 4th of 5 is a good rating for this.
There you
this.
Go. Clever.
No, but I think from the meta level too, the fact that they don't do anything as interesting with this, again, not having seen Voyager, not knowing where that goes, I don't feel like the Borg, the next few Borg appearances don't justify the ending of this episode. As a full episode, though, this is one of my, this is one that I was very excited that we were going to, you know, rewatch this for this show, for example. And, you know, I do love the character of Hugh. I love the performance. Anytime to see Guinan. And, I mean, this is an emotionally tense episode. We have Crusher as openly disagreeing with Picard as any time on the show, which, given the mandate on everyone has to agree, is a very interesting, you know, I like seeing that because it's something we don't normally see.
The Brig, Doctor. You'll bring your supplies to the Brig. that line. And also, we never even talked about the Picard as Locutus scene, which I think is excellent, too.
He
assumes the mantle of Locutus.
Well, I think it's what that was, because in DS9, there are a few characters who have a similar type of authority that they didn't quite earn, but that for whatever their position are, they have, and we see their reluctance to take it. I found it very interesting that the second, you know, Picard realizing he has Locutus power, he takes it. You know, that says something very about him. He is able to just slot into this. And, you know, I that scene, you see him wanting the Borg to turn into a monster and attack him. And he's, like, trying to bait this thing. And we feel bad for Hugh in that scene, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that the way Patrick Stewart plays that is the way I felt Hugh should have been played for most of the episode. Mm. Like, very confident in it. You know, like, we are the Borg. This is the way it always is. This is how it happens.
Yeah.
I just feel he becomes a little bit too childish too soon in the episode. But, Eric, what are you going to give this guy?
I think I'll give it a 4, too. I think this is the first time that we've all given it the same rating. But
yep.
Yeah, I think
wow, a hive mind.
That's right. Yeah, that's very thematic.
I mean, yeah, it is a very strong episode. I think there's a lot of meaty stuff to talk about, as we just did. And at the same time, I'm kind of with Wes, where I have to grade this on a little bit of a curve, and I don't give it a 5 just because I know what this does to the Borg and where it goes after this. And, you know, it's got a lot of really classic Star Trek things about tolerance and diversity and all that kind of stuff and cooperation, and you can deal with anybody on an even basis. But at the same time, it is suffering a little bit from late TNG syndrome. So, yeah,
I think it's starting to have a descent.
Yeah.
Well, at least there's no nebula that they go into and some space alien is in it. I'm starting to, having to watch them all in a row, I've become hyper aware of the fact that when they don't have a good story, there's a formula that they stick to.
Yeah.
There's the A character story with a terrible sci-fi B plot that sometimes doesn't even connect at all to it. When the episodes are very good, they get away from that and they don't do it. But that's the formula. And I'm also starting to notice that there is an excessive amount of nebulas that have something strange going on inside them. And that's about it.
Listen, man, we've been through this and we know your pain. We know you've got a lot. It's only going to get harder from here on in. But
you guys have been doing this for years now. You're just into, yeah, you've seen everything that they could possibly come up with.
Yeah, we've been doing this for almost 4 years.
I think I would say next year is our 5 year. We're about to record our 200th episode, I think.
Yeah, in a few weeks. So it's kind of crazy.
I'm surprised it's almost that low. Yeah, and you've just finished, you didn't run through all the Next Generation movies because you're going to splice them out across DS9, I'd assume, for narrative making sense.
Pretty much. There's just a couple. We actually, like I said, we just recorded the First Contact podcast and because we record a little bit ahead of time. And yeah, I wanted to do that between the 4th and 5th seasons of DS9 just because of the Defiance in it. And that's really the only reason. I mean, the TNG movies don't really have spoilers about DS9 very much.
So it's not like Quark is a character in, you know, Insurrection.
No. They always have to explain where Worf is and why he's back. Like, that's always have a scene that has to explain how that happened.
Yeah. So we're.
We're doing one after DS9 and one after Voyager or something like that.
I'm putting Nemesis off as far as possible because who the hell wants to watch Nemesis?
I don't know anything about it.
Nemesis is
Nemeshit.
No, I think it's underrated. I don't think it's good. I think it's underrated. But anyway, guys, do you want to plug? Tell people where they can find you.
Yeah. So if they would like to check out our podcast, where we're going through the entirety of the Star Trek franchise, two episodes at a time, go to trekaboutshow.com.
Absolutely. And they also they do movie podcasts occasionally. You can also find that on trekaboutshow.com. Just finished up Kevin Smith's run.
Yes. And the next one we're going to do is Ghostbusters.
Just the Ghostbusters 1?
We're going to do Ghostbusters 1, 2, and the new Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that makes sense.
And Lost in Translation because Bill Murray.
Yeah, that too.
Sure. That makes sense. There's a lot of it's the same universe as Ghostbusters, so it all makes sense when you think about it that way.
Exactly.
Guys, thank you very much for coming on the show. Anybody listening to this show, if you enjoyed the content, I'd appreciate it if you left a like and a comment on YouTube, or a rating and review on iTunes helps get the show out there. A lot of good comments recently on YouTube. People getting fired up about the late stages of season 5. Not really, but thank you very much for all your feedback. It's been helpful. And it's a reason to keep making these things and putting them out on the internet. So guys, check them out. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having us again. It was fun.
Absolutely. Guys, go check them out. And I will be back in a day or two with the next phase, the sci-fi episode that has one huge plot hole in it. So until then, see ya.
Oh, yeah.